wrappers held up by one essential material, wood. Yet even the simplest material is denied to Gaza's displaced families. Wooden pallets, once lying discarded on the roadside, have become a treasure for anyone desperate to keep a tent standing against wind and rain. That's what Rami Ibrahim understood. With his worn-out saw and a rusty hammer, he set up a small makeshift workshop, salvaging every splinter he could collect. From sunrise to sunset, Rami and his children worked together, cracking boards apart, pounding nails, and joining short pieces into long, sturdy supports, repurposing scraps into the pillars that can hold fragile shelters standing.
Most of us now live in tents, as no caravans or suitable housing units have arrived. While many people break down these pallets for firewood, I try to collect them from those who fetch them after aid or commercial deliveries. My children and I carefully transformed these scraps into something usable. I even built my own workshop structure from this wood. As the weather grows harsher, at least when people lose their tents, they can find an affordable alternative.
Here in Gaza, wood has become a rare commodity, not for furniture, but for survival. With materials blocked by Israel, the scraps of wood recycled here are the only option for many displaced families to hold their tents from collapsing.
For the displaced families, the fear is no longer limited to Israel's bombs. Even the weather can tear their tents down. On a nearby road, Abu Ihab has just got a few wooden boards from the workshop. He lays them to rebuild a new tent after his previous shelter collapsed under the brutal conditions. With only a handful of boards, he hopes this rebuilt structure will withstand the winds this time, offering his family even a fragile sense of stability.
This isn't the first time I've used these wooden boards. They cracked during the last storm and caused my tent to collapse. Now, I got them again from a nearby workshop. But we really need stronger wood and tarps. What would truly help are proper housing units. Yet, they still haven't arrived, leaving us trapped in this endless cycle.
For Abu Ihab and countless others, the meaning of refuge has long been lost in the ruins of the homes Israel destroyed. No matter how many times they rebuilt or reinforced their tents, the struggle remains the same. Families continue searching for materials or any form of proper shelter, but what they truly need remains out of reach as long as Israel blocks the entry of essential construction supplies. Ahmed al-Najjar, Khan Yunis, Palestine.
A diverse range of programs. Youth, spirituality, culture, Eastern tales, roundtable discussions, politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
From Tehran to the world, welcome to Iran Radio, your window into thoughtful programming and global perspectives. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. There are an estimated 1.8 billion Muslims in the world, which is about 1.5% of the world's population. Due to birth and conversion rates, Islam is considered to be the fastest growing religion in the world today. I'm so glad to have you with us. As the day unfolds, we'll explore the moments that shape our lives, the voices that inspire us, and the stories that bring meaning to the everyday. Let's begin this journey together. Our next program is Minbar. After that, we will have another segment of radio productions for this broadcast. Next up, The Lantern illuminates moral stories. This program expounds and explains moral teachings from an Islamic perspective through the telling of fables and stories that are rich in morals. So stay with us for your next program, Minbar.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, ista'inu bis-sabri was-salah.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life. complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we will listen to the speech of Sheikh Osama Abdul Ghani.
So dear brothers and sisters in Islam, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Now brothers and sisters, we were covering why it is that it's possible for us to not have ikhlas, right? We said that Quranic ikhlas is something else. We discovered that it is impossible to have Quranic ikhlas without considering Allah to be azim and kabir. And many believers, like us, were suffering with the idea that Allah is not kabir. Allah is not azim, not practically. Now, just for clarification. Now, the spiritual teachers have taught us about the bare minimum level of ikhlas that we need to have. The bare minimum, so we don't have to consider ourselves munafiqeen and riyad and stuff like that. The bare minimal amount of ikhlas that we have to have, and that we have and we enjoy, alhamdulillah, is that I do what I'm supposed to do for the sake of Allah. I'm carrying out my duties for the sake of Allah. That level of ikhlas we do have, that's enough, alhamdulillah. Is that the Quranic expectation of ikhlas? No. We have to remind ourselves of where we need to be. What's the Quranic expectation of ikhlas? We studied this verse before. Allah says in the Quran, Surah 6, verse 162, قُلْ, He tells the Prophet, say, إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِي لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Quranic ikhlas is the ayat of Quran. Say, truly my prayer and the other acts of worship, my life and my death are lillahi rabbil alameen. So that level of ikhlas, that's not there. Okay. What will happen if I settle with being mediocre? Instead of pushing for that Quranic level of ikhlas, what happens to the Muslim who settles? If we do settle, brothers and sisters, there's one scary thing that happens. One of the scary things that happens is this. A person who doesn't have Quranic ikhlas goes through life looking for the results of their actions. And this is very scary. I just did this for Allah. What did I get in return? I did the right thing. I'm looking for the results of my actions, and that is deadly. Especially, let's say somebody satisfies themselves with this kind of level of ikhlas, instead of the ikhlas that we're looking for, where the responsibility becomes important, and they engage in spiritual wafering. Of course, spiritual wafering is for me to better myself, but if I'm looking for results, that's not what Islam teaches. Let me explain. For a person of ikhlas, my amal and the results are one. What I was trying to do and what I got out of this situation are exactly one. Instead of a person of ikhlas feeling frustrated, the person of ikhlas feels I got what I was looking for. The person of ikhlas regards Allah as great, Allah as azim. The other results of the action, that's nurun ala nur. If I get God, that's the prize. Let me tell you how Imam Sajjad tells us to think. This is how he addresses Allah. He says, Ya na'imi wa jannati. Oh Allah, you are my na'im. You are my paradise. Ya dunyaya wa akhirati. You are my dunya. You are my akhirah. The person of ikhlas gets God. And that's what I was looking for. I want to give you a practical example. In Islam, brothers and sisters, we are taught to be tolerant, to put up with people. And it's natural. I'm going through life. There's different cultures, different personalities. We're dealing with individuals. People are sensitive about certain things. Islam teaches us a concept called modara, to be tolerant. To the extent that I'm able to be flexible without compromising what Allah says, Allah's commanded me to do this. Hadith. The hadith says this, Amarani Rabbi, my Lord commanded me, bi mudarat an-nas kama amarani bi ada' al-fara'id. Allah commanded me to be tolerant, to work with people, to be flexible in the same way that He's commanded me to carry out my wajibat. So my red line in flexibility is I can't cross God's red lines in order to make you happy. But otherwise, I try as hard as humanly possible to be able to be tolerant. And now, if a person has ikhlas, let's say I was tolerant. I was in a situation, somebody else did the wrong thing. I tried to put up with it. I tried to be the better person. I tried to walk a higher path. And the other person didn't do their responsibility. Allah told me to do mudara. I did mudara. The other person didn't do their job. If I'm a person of ikhlas, I got what I was looking for. I got God. I just won. The other person, if they do their job, nurun ala nur. I'm not fixated on the results. I don't get depressed if the results aren't there. If I did what God said, I won. Hadith, and then after that, Masad. The hadith is from Imam Sajjad. He says this, من أحب السبيل إلى الله عز وجل جرعتان. Amongst the most beloved paths to God. Allah is my Jannah. Allah is my dunya. Allah is my akhirah. Amongst the most beloved paths to Allah, he says, are two jura, two drinks. Let's call them two bitter drinks. He says, one of them, jura'atu ghaydhin. One of them is a situation that angers the mu'min. The believer is furious with what just happened. But I did my job. I swallowed my anger. The imam says, yarudduha bihilmin. The believer was halim. They did their responsibility. I got what I was looking for. The other one, wajur'atu musibatin. The other one is a catastrophe, a calamity. I did my job. It didn't fix itself. Yarudduha bisabrin. The person of ikhlas is patient, and then I win by doing what Allah said. We ask that Allah accept what was said and heard in His way. We end with salawat ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Samir Shammer, welcome here, my dear friend. Before we talk about can Europe save Ukraine, I just finished reading a great piece that you wrote. It may have been derived from a speech that you gave on the bleak future that Europe has. But before we get there, our dear friend and colleague Alistair Crook is reporting that Israeli press is reporting that Prime Minister Netanyahu is threatening Israeli President Herzog over the issue of the pardon, and contrary to Israeli law, is unwilling to admit guilt and unwilling to leave public office. I'm going to guess that you're not surprised by any of this.
Hardly at all. I mean, Netanyahu is someone who is deeply committed to remaining in office for as long as he possibly can. And as we've talked about on the show, he's done a brilliant job at prolonging his tenure as prime minister, given the fact that he was the prime minister on October 7th when Israel was caught by surprise and suffered that devastating defeat that day. And furthermore, given that he has been under indictment and has been in court for well over a year now, the fact that he survived is quite remarkable. He has no intention of leaving office. So he'll cut a deal, but it's only if it's a deal that leaves him in office and basically leaves him unscathed.
I'm going to guess that this doesn't surprise you either. The Financial Times is reporting that Arab leaders have told President Trump that they will not accept Tony Blair on the so-called Trump Peace Board, and they absolutely reject him. I'm trying to say this with a straight face, as the governor general. I can't imagine that. He's going to live in Gaza anyway. They're going to reject him as the governor general of Gaza.
No, it's very interesting. Is Haaretz has a big piece today that says in the headline that Tony Blair has been visiting Netanyahu since October 7th on a frequent basis.
I saw that.
Yeah. So, I mean, this guy is in bed with the Israelis. The idea that he's going to be the one who administers Gaza. I mean, when you think about what's going on with regard to Gaza, it's really quite amazing. The two principal negotiators for the United States are Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner, who are dyed-in-the-wool Zionists. They should not be negotiating for the United States with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And then you throw in Tony Blair, who's not much different than Kushner, and Witkoff. This looks like a colonial enterprise, what Trump is trying to do in Gaza. There's no self-determination whatsoever for the Palestinians in this deal that he's concocted for Gaza. There's no political horizon. There's no self-determination. Basically, he's going to have a bunch of Europeans running it, and he's going to be nominally in charge, he meaning Trump, and then they're going to bring in some Arab and Islamic countries to police the place. This is the idea. This is a non-starter. It's just not going to work. By the way, just to take this a step further, a number of countries, Pakistan, Indonesia, for example, who have been mentioned as possible countries that would put peacekeeping forces in Gaza, have said they will not go into Gaza until Hamas is disarmed. And Hamas, of course, is not going to disarm. They'd be crazy to disarm because there is no hope of a political endgame for the Palestinians. There's no self-determination here. If Hamas disarmed, they'd leave themselves wide open to the IDF.
Can Netanyahu claim with a straight face, suppose we could stop right there and I could just fill in the blank. Anybody could fill in the blank. Can he claim with a straight face that his government is abiding by the Witkoff, Kushner, Trump so-called ceasefire?
Not with a straight face. I mean, if you look at what's happening in Lebanon, if you look at what's happening in Gaza, there's abundant evidence, a superabundant evidence that the Israelis are not abiding by the ceasefire. They violated on a consistent basis in Lebanon, and they violated on a consistent basis in Gaza. And what does the United States do in these cases? It stands idly by and allows the Israelis to do whatever they want. We continue to fund them, and we continue to give them equipment and support them diplomatically if they ever get into any trouble.
Just like the Congress of the United States sits idly by and lets the president do whatever he wants, even when he's murdering people on the high seas in the Caribbean Ocean, 1,500 miles from the United States.
That's true. But at least the Congress is beginning to get cold feet. They're beginning to get nervous.
Right.
You don't see any of that in terms of how Trump deals with the Israelis or how Congress deals with the Israelis. And that's basically because, as I've said on numerous occasions, the lobby owns Trump and the lobby owns Congress.
Right, right, right. I mean, is there any feasible way to stop these killings, these criminal acts on the Caribbean, other than perhaps scaring Congress into thinking its members will not be reelected once the public sees the murders on film?
That's possible. I'd say the likelihood of that happening is in the range of 5 to 10%.
Wow.
I mean, the truth is, if Congress decided to take the bull by the horns and get tough with Trump, I think he'd just ignore them.
Here's Senator Rand Paul, actually earlier today on this. Chris, cut number 10.
We've been doing this for 30 years. When the Coast Guard picks up boats off of Venezuela, which we have done historically, about 1 in 4 of the boats, maybe 1 in 5, don't have drugs. So we make mistakes. Are we willing to execute people with a 20% error rate? This is an insane policy. It's inconsistent. It's not war, and it's not the way we've ever done this. Think about it. If we can blow up a boat in the ocean that is at war with us because of the drugs, what about when they get to Miami and they put it in a truck, and the truck's going from Miami to Orlando? Can you shoot a grenade launcher at the truck? No, we arrest people because sometimes we're wrong. You know, the make and the model of the truck is this, and oh, we made a mistake. That was somebody on vacation. We don't blow up people without first arresting them. And this is the way it's been done on the high seas for 100 years or more. And what we're doing now is just plain wrong.
The classic constitutionally faithful clarion cry for something as simple and basic as due process.
I agree. It's hard to disagree with anything that Senator Paul said. I would also note that I think that it's very important that people pay attention to the rule of law, both domestically and internationally. I mean, we have laws for good reason. And I understand that sometimes countries have to violate the law because it's in their security, it's in their national interest. It makes sense from a security point of view. But you want to minimize the number of times you do that and otherwise follow the law as much as possible. And the same thing is true at the domestic level. And in this country, with regard to our leadership, and I think it was true with the Biden administration as well, paying attention to the law was just not that important. We thought we could do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And the only difference between the Biden administration and the Trump administration at the international level is that the Biden administration trumpeted the virtues of the international legal system, the rule of law internationally, while in practice they were stomping all over it. The Trump administration, at least, is consistent. They're constantly railing against the rules-based order or international law, while at the same time traipsing all over it.
Well, see if you can figure out what the president meant here, because first he says we will release the second tape, the tape showing the survivors clinging onto chunks of wood for 45 minutes before they were murdered. And then he said, I never said I'd release the tape. And then he said he wasn't sure what he said. Listen, see if you can figure it out. What he means, number 11.
Mr. President, you released video of that first boat strike on September 2nd, but not the second video. Will you release video of that strike so that the American people can see for themselves what happened?
I don't know what they have, but whatever they have, we'd certainly release, no problem.
Mr. President, you said you would have no problem with releasing the full video of that strike on September 2nd off the coast of Venezuela.
Secretary Hegseth now says...
You said that. I didn't say that. This is ABC fake news.
you said that you would have no problem releasing the full bit. Okay, well, Secretary Hegseth.
No, whatever Hegseth wants to do is okay with
me. He now says it's under review. Are you ordering the secretary to release that full video?
Well, whatever he decides is okay with me.
Are you committed to releasing the full video?
Didn't I just tell you that?
You said that it was
You're
up to Secretary Hegseth.
You're the most obnoxious reporter in the whole place. Let me just tell you, you are an obnoxious, a terrible reporter.
Well, this is really ridiculous coming from the President of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, what can you say at this point?
All right, let's transition. When the Kremlin agreed to disband the Warsaw Pact, why did the United States stay in NATO?
We stayed in NATO because we understood that we served as a pacifier in Europe, or at least in the western half of Europe. As long as NATO was intact, that meant the United States was there, and it had its security umbrella over the West Europeans. Now, it's very important to understand that when the Soviets disbanded the Warsaw Pact, they were nevertheless content to leave NATO intact. They were content to allow the United States to remain in Europe because the Soviets understood that we did act as a pacifier. And this is especially relevant with regard to West Germany, which was in the process of becoming Germany. Because you remember at the end of the Cold War, Germany was reunified. So the German reunification caused worries all across Europe. And people thought that the best way to deal with that potential problem was to keep NATO intact, which meant keep the Americans in Europe. We bought that argument, the Europeans bought that argument, and the Soviets and later the Russians bought that argument. So there's no problem there. Where does the problem come? It comes with NATO expansion.
Right.
You well know, Judge, we told the Soviets that we would not expand NATO, that it would not be expanded eastward. And then the Clinton administration came along and they decided in 1994 that NATO would be expanded. And that is the principal source of the problem today. Had we not expanded NATO, and certainly if we had not expanded NATO or tried to expand NATO into Ukraine, Europe, I believe, would be peaceful today.
Instead, you have argued, this is a great piece, it's at the American Conservative, it probably appears elsewhere. Did you give it as a speech, or did you write it as an editorial?
No, I gave it as a speech before the European Parliament.
Okay, because I could hear your voice and rejoice in some of your favorite figures of speech, and you argued so powerfully that Europe's future is bleak. Why do you say that?
Well, it's very bleak for two reasons. One is there's not going to be a happy ending to the Ukraine war. The Russians are going to win an ugly victory. Ukraine is going to be destroyed. And very importantly, relations between Russia on one side and Ukraine and Europe on the other side are going to be poisonous. And they're going to be dangerous because there's always a possibility, given all the flashpoints that exist in Eastern Europe, that a war will break out again. So once the war ends, once the shooting stops and you get some sort of armistice or frozen conflict, the potential for conflict, armed conflict, is still going to be there. And you want to remember you're operating in an environment where there are poisonous relations. The other point, and this is of great importance, is that the United States is pivoting to Asia in a major way. You see this in the new national security strategy that the Trump administration has just put out. We view China as our principal concern, and there's a great deal of emphasis in the administration, and especially with Trump himself, in focusing on East Asia and leaving the Europeans to defend for themselves. So what I'm saying here, Judge, is that if we pivot to East Asia, which I think is likely, the end result is that NATO will definitely collapse, or it certainly will be a shell of its former self. And the end result is that the Europeans will be on their own to provide for their own security. And the Europeans live in fear of that possibility. So I think when you put all these things together, together, it's a very bleak future for Europe.
So the Sun of London, which is a tabloid, reports just a few minutes ago that a British soldier was killed in Ukraine. Now, Colonel McGregor informs that many British special forces and MI6 have been killed, but none of it's been revealed. This time they revealed it because it happened in some sort of a training accident, and the press was there, and the guy was in uniform. Is this going to affect the Kremlin thinking at all, that a British soldier in uniform was killed in Ukraine?
No, I don't think they're going to care at all, for two reasons. One, I'm sure they already know that there are British soldiers in Ukraine. Not many of them, but some of them. The fact is, the Russians are principally concerned with waging the war on the battlefield, and whether there are 10 British soldiers, 100 British soldiers, or even 1,000 British soldiers just doesn't matter very much. And more importantly, the British are not going to put in 1,000 soldiers. They're not going to directly engage in the fight in any meaningful way. So this just doesn't matter very much.
If you had been a fly on the wall at 10 Downing Street yesterday when Volodymyr Zelensky showed up and was greeted by Sir Keir Starmer, President Emmanuel Macron, and Chancellor Merz, what do you think you would have heard? What could they possibly say to him? They can't raise taxes. They can't borrow money. Belgium won't let them steal the money from the Belgian banks. What can they do for him?
Well, unless they can steal that money, those frozen Russian assets from Euroclear, there's hardly anything they can do. Ukraine is certainly doomed if that proves to be the case. So I think what they probably told Zelensky at this point in time is to hold the line, and they would do everything they can to steal that money and make sure that Ukraine gets the $100+ billion that it desperately needs so they can continue the war. I mean, there's no question that the Europeans, much like the Ukrainians, are profoundly committed to keeping this war going. They obviously think that there's some chance that the Russians will collapse before Ukraine collapses, and that we will emerge, we meaning the West, and the Ukrainians will emerge victorious. I think this is tilting at windmills, but it's quite clear that the Europeans seem to believe that.
President Trump, in another one of his rants, we don't have it on tape, apparently said he doesn't like the Europeans, he doesn't trust them, and he's thinking of walking away from Ukraine. Now, he said that before, so I don't know that we can put much credence in it. And we just watched that clip where he said, yeah, release the tape, and 5 hours later denied that he had said it. So these sort of wild, almost ridiculous, at times hilarious interactions with the press in the Oval Office, I don't think they can really be fairly used as a window into his thinking.
Well, one way of thinking about what's going on, which ties this discussion of Trump to the previous question about the three European leaders and Zelensky, is that everybody now understands that Ukraine is going to lose. And the question is, who's going to get the blame? Who's going to bear the responsibility for the loss? And one could argue that Trump will not simply walk away from Ukraine, because that will then allow the Ukrainians, and especially the Europeans, to blame him for the collapse of Ukraine. So the smart thing for Trump to do in this story is to say, this is a European responsibility, and I will do everything I can to help the Europeans keep the Ukrainians afloat. So that's the Trump perspective. From the European side of the equation, there, I think they want to fight and fight and fight, fight to the last Ukrainian, so they cannot be accused of having bailed out on Ukraine, and can actually make the argument that it's Trump who's responsible for Ukraine's collapse. So what I'm saying to you here is, I have to believe, given what's happening on the battlefield, that the Europeans, certainly Donald Trump, understand that Ukraine is doomed, that they're going to lose this war, and there's no way of turning the tide. And therefore, the question is a blame game, or the question is who gets the blame? You're involved.
Right. And I Trump is a master at deflecting blame.
Oh, he's brilliant at that. And the Europeans are very good at that as well. Mm. Because you want to understand that this is going to be a catastrophic defeat. This is not a minor defeat. This is not like losing in Afghanistan. Right? This is a major war where Europe and the United States, or NATO more generally, was on one side, and the Russians were on the other.
Well, you know who he'll blame it on. He'll blame it on Biden, and Biden does bear a lot of blame, but he does, Trump, as well, for arming the Ukrainians before Biden was in office and for continuing to arm them after he came to office the second time. Here is his statement, a bizarre statement he made, as if that's news, on Saturday, claiming that President Zelensky hasn't even, I don't know how he could know this, hasn't even read the so-called 28-point proposal. There's a little bit more in there. We'll let you see it and hear it now. Chris, number six.
What's your next step in Russia-Ukraine talks after last week's negotiations?
So we've been speaking to President Putin, and we've been speaking to Ukrainian leaders, including Zelensky, President Zelensky. And I have to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that President Zelensky hasn't yet read the proposal. That was as of a few hours ago. His people love it, but he hasn't. Russia's fine with it. Russia, I guess, would rather have the whole country when you think of it. But Russia is, I believe, fine with it. But I'm not sure that Zelensky is fine with it. His people love it, but he hasn't read it.
Really crazy. His people don't love it. Russia's not fine with it. How could he know whether or not it's been read? That was, by the way, Sunday evening. I misspoke when I said Saturday.
The Russians don't accept this 28-point plan. The Ukrainian people, and I assume by that he means all of Zelensky's advisors, all the key national security establishment figures in Ukraine, they don't accept this plan for one second.
Right.
Zelensky himself, I can't believe he hasn't read it. I'm sure he has, but he surely knows what's in it if he hasn't read it, and he completely rejects it. This is what he said yesterday when he talked to the press after meeting with the three European leaders. Doesn't accept the deal. Nobody accepts the deal. That's the problem. There's no deal to be had here.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Stories from the Past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles.
stories from different parts of the world.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, dear brother and sister, salam. So, welcome to a new story. Yes, this is another episode of Lantern, and we have a new story entitled Mature in Intellect. Welcome to Lantern. With the intention of suppressing a group of rebellious enemies existing around Mecca and Medina, the noble prophet, peace be upon him and his family, readied a rapid strike command until for the purpose of advancing secretly upon the enemies in the darkness of the night and overcoming them, and appointed a youth from the tribe of Hudayl as the commander of this unit. A shallow-minded person remonstrated, saying, "Why have you appointed a youth as our chief? We refuse to obey his orders. You ought to have appointed an elderly person as the chief and commander of the army." The noble prophet said, "O shallow-minded person, although he is a youth, nevertheless, he possesses a strong heart and a sound intellect, whereas the elders that you talk about, although they possess white beards and apparently should be given the leadership, however, their hearts are dark as pitch. On numerous occasions, I have put this youth to test and found him to be mature in intellect. Elderly in age but lacking in intellect yields no benefit. Strive to the maximum extent possible to be elderly in the intellect and religion, for leadership is determined not by age but by intelligence, reflection, and a pure, luminous heart." Now we'll listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern, and the important points of this nice story.
We seek refuge from Satan the cursed in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, dear audience. Welcome to a new episode of Lantern from IRIB English Radio. This is Zainab Musavi, and in Lantern, what we do is to listen to a set of religious stories and then try to talk and explore some more points that we can take out of these stories and make use of them in our daily lives. Well, maturity is often imagined as something that arrives with age, as though the passing of years automatically sharpens insight and deepens character. Yet the reality of life, history, and revelation tells a different story. True maturity is not tied to the number of years that a person lives. It is tied to the clarity of their intellect, the depth of their understanding, and the sincerity of their hearts. In the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, intellect is the basis of value. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, قَيْمَةُ كُلِّ مْرَئِي مَا يُحْسِنُهُ. The worth of every person is in what they excel in, meaning the excellence of their understanding and reason, not their age or appearance. In another narration, he states that Al-Aqlu Rasulul Haqq, intellect is the messenger of truth. These words shift the discussion entirely. Maturity is measured by the strength of one's inner compass, not by the length of one's lifespan. The Holy Book of Quran also points to the same truth. In Surah Al-Zumar, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم هل يستوي الذين يعلمون والذين لا يعلمون Are those who know equal to those who do not know? Verse 9 of Surah Al-Zumar. This is not a question about age. It is a question about awareness. Who reflects, who understands, who acts based on insight? Knowledge, not age, is what separates maturity from immaturity. And in another verse, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala describes the people of understanding as those who remember their Lord, standing, sitting, and lying down, and those who reflect on the creation of the heavens and the earth. This refers to Surah Al-Imran, verse number 191. This reflection, this internal movement of thought, is the essence of maturity. People who take time to examine themselves, question their motives, and understand the consequences of their actions grow intellectually and spiritually, regardless of whether they are young or old. Maturity, so, is not something one inherits. It is something that one builds. The Imams teach that the intellect grows when a person practices restraint, humility, and sincerity. Many people grow older but never allow themselves to think deeply enough to truly change. Their age increases, but their maturity remains fixed at the level where they stopped reflecting. Okay, well, let's go have a short break and we will be back in no time.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
Welcome back to your audience. You're listening to Lantern and we are talking about maturity and its requirement, which is not, definitely not, old age. Well, maturity shows itself in the way a person handles responsibility. One may find a young individual who takes responsibility for their actions, the one who admits mistakes and sees improvement. And one may find an older adult who blames others, who avoids accountability, and who repeats the same behaviors endlessly. Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam says, "Man ta'aqqal a'tabar, wa man i'tabar absar." Whoever uses their intellect will take lessons, and whoever takes lessons will see clearly. The chain is simple. Thinking leads to insight, and insight leads to clarity. Now, let's remember that a young person with understanding may be more mature than an elder without it. And an elder with a humble, reflective heart may surpass the young person in clarity and wisdom. What matters is not when we were born, but how we chose to think, how we chose to live, and how we chose to grow. Okay, well, dear listeners, it seems that our time for this episode of Lantern has come to its end. I really hope that you have enjoyed listening to us. And until another episode, I bid you farewell and may Allah protect you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Dear brother and sister, thank you very much for your company. This is the end of this episode of Lantern. Until a new story, fi aman Allah.
Ana bi dhikrillahi tatma'innu.
to all our wonderful listeners. You are on Iran Radio, right here in the vibrant capital, Tehran. I'm thrilled to bring you the next wave of fresh, inspiring programs. Let's dive in. Our next program is News, keeping you in the know with all the latest updates. Then you can enjoy another segment of our diverse radio productions. Next up, Islamic upbringing guides parents with faith-based wisdom. This program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. The questions answered all gathered from various sources, such as the internet or from listeners themselves. The answers are based on Quranic teachings and narrations from Prophet Muhammad and his progeny, as well as psychological studies. Next up, it's time for the news this hour. Stay with us.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. Thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The World Health Organization warns about Gaza's deteriorating health conditions, saying most of the territory's hospitals and health centers are just partially functional. Protesters in Venezuela condemn U.S. military's recent seizure of an oil tanker, declaring their readiness to defend their independence against foreign intervention. And at least two people are killed in a shooting attack at Brown University in the U.S. state of Rhode Island. Officials say attacker is still at large. Hello, everyone, and welcome to World News. Israel has carried out fresh attacks in Gaza in further violation of the ceasefire with Hamas. Southern cities of Khan Yunis and Rafah are among areas that have witnessed new strikes. And to hear more on Israeli violations in Gaza, we're there joined by our correspondent, Gada Abraham, out of Deir al-Bala.
Since the beginning of the U.S. broken ceasefire agreement, from time to time we are still hearing the Israeli artillery shelling targeting the eastern bars of Deir al-Bala city, the eastern bars of Al-Maghazi and Al-Ibrej refugee camp while we are here in the middle area, and also the eastern bars of Khan Yunis city, which was the focal point of the Israeli attack since the beginning of the ceasefire agreement. To the eastern bars of Gaza city as well, the Israeli attacks are continuous on the eastern bars of Al-Sha'af neighborhood, the eastern bars of Al-Tufah and Al-Shija'iyah, and in addition to this, the northern parts of Jabalia refugee camp and the northern parts of Beit Lahia as well. In the past 24 hours, we have witnessed 8 Palestinians killed as a result of Israeli attacks on different areas. One Palestinian man or young man was killed in a